Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the President and Emergency Powers. And Richard, as we're recording this, we are now in the third week of a shutdown of the federal government that hinges on the fact that President Trump does not want to sign any new budgetary appropriations unless they include the little over $5 billion that he wants for a physical wall on the southern border with Mexico. Now, in recent days, the president has floated the idea that if he does not get assent from Congress on that point, he may consider, this is still just conditional, he may consider declaring an emergency and using the military to build the wall. So let's start here. As a constitutional or statutory matter, as the case may be, what do we mean by emergency powers? Under what circumstances are presidents empowered to do things that they couldn't normally do?
This is a billion-dollar question, and it goes back a very, very long time. There is a deep history on emergencies that covers not only the federal government and the president, but also covers a whole variety of circumstances. When can you destroy property under conditions of emergencies and so forth? The traditional definition of an emergency is very closely tied to the notion of a private or a public necessity. And what this typically means is that there is some large, overpowering, distinctive event that suddenly comes upon you. It can be an earthquake. It can be a flood. It can be some kind of a military disaster. And what happens is, given the sudden nature of this particular situation and its magnitude, to try to go through the usual principles whereby you get congressional authorization or state legislative authorization means that it's going to be too little and too late. And so what happens is it's widely understood that executive power at any level is highest at that. So to give you but one example coming straight from the Constitution, what happens is the usual principle of separation of power says that Congress has the power to declare war but not to raise it is the implication. And the president as commander-in-chief has the power to raise it but not to declare it. There is then the following discussion. Suppose the other guys are not playing by the Marquess of Queensberry rules, and what they do is they launch a sudden attack upon the United States. Pearl Harbor would be a nice example. Do we say that we're not allowed to fight back against the enemy until we declare war against them, at which point we're sitting ducks? No, everybody understands that the military can respond with the use of force. The president can authorize the use of force. There is no impediment whatsoever against the use of force to respond to that kind of an emergency. This sort of emergency was involved, for example, during the Civil War. It seemed as though, I think the accounts are accurate, that the state of Maryland was in a real sort of toss-up situation. The legislature was being very fractious, and there was at least some chance that the thing might go over and become part of the Confederacy. And what our friend Lincoln did is he sent federal forces in there, suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and basically took over the place so that would not happen. And the question is whether or not he was so authorized to do so, given the fact that habeas corpus is normally a judicial process. What happened was people said there was an emergency. Mr. Tawney said, I don't really think you can do this. But there was nothing in the Constitution which said that when you wanted to suspend habeas corpus, it had to be done by Congress or the president. It's what I like to call the constitutional passive. You know it can be done, but you have no idea by whom. And I think in the end, Lincoln's position was correct, given the nature of the emergency. What he did is he moved, because if he waited, it would have been too late. And then afterwards, Congress ratified the particular decision so as to give it a kind of legitimacy that it might have otherwise had happened. Well, you put this against the wall. This has been a problem which has been festering for 10 years. There's been all sorts of opportunities for action to be taken by Congress, which has systematically declined to do so. The closest parallel on this in recent years dates to the so-called steel seizure cases in the early 1950s, when what Truman did as part of the war effort against Korea was to seize control of the steel companies because he claimed there would be an interruption in supply of weaponry that would otherwise have to be sent to the front. And he was rebuffed by the United States Supreme Court. They decided decision with multiple rationales. But one of the key features about this one was on the question of whether or not the president, as commander-in-chief, has the power to take over the mills, there had been extensive deliberations in Congress at some earlier days, and it seemed as though he was denied that kind of power when they tried to put into place the Labor Management Act of 1947, which essentially did give, through an explicit statutory scheme, an 80-day cooling-off period with respect to one of these not quite but serious emergencies, shutting down a transportation system, for example, where once people get off the train, it's parallels. It's not the same as the manufacturing industry, and everybody knows it. And Justice Black, in saying, nope, Mr. Truman, you can't do it, referred to that. Well, this case looks very much like the steel seizure case. It doesn't look at all like the situation that we had with Lincoln. It doesn't look at all like the sneak attack in a kind of war. And so in my view, it doesn't fall within the category of an emergency. It falls into the category of a long-suffering open wound in which there are deep policy differences between the two sides. But if for it to be an emergency, there would have to be some new and sudden transformation of the situation. All we can say about this particular problem is, if anything, the migration across the border, the southern border, was greater 20 years ago than it is today. In fact, it's not even clear which way the majority of the traffic is actually moving. So I don't think by any stretch of the imagination this could count as an emergency unless you want to use it in a somewhat Pickwickian sense of the term.
In the sort of maelstrom around this issue, there's probably been insufficient attention paid to a kind of sub-argument the president has been making. If one were to build this continuous wall across the southern border, one would have to confiscate a fair amount of private land in the process. The federal government does not own that entire stretch, which runs about 2,000 miles. And the president's response to that has been saying that he could use what he calls the military version of eminent domain. So my hyper-articulate question for you, Richard, is that a thing? Are there qualitatively different powers of eminent domain where the military is concerned, and would they be applicable here?
There are a bunch of cases that do deal with the question of whether compensation is owed or when, in fact, the military orders not the construction of a wall, but the destruction of American facilities. And these cases arose during the Second World War, when the rapid Japanese advance meant that American facilities owned, I think it was by Caltech, some oil company, could fall into Japanese hands. And what the American military did is it basically destroyed them so it would not fall over. And then a takings clause was brought against it. And what happened was essentially the emergency claims, by and large, trumped the eminent domain. And the argument really very simply was this: we don't take these things over. They fall into Japanese hands. The Japanese are going to destroy them if we should come after them. So what happens is you were a goner one way or the other. And to the extent that the United States doesn't hurt you in any material sense, but benefits the country at large, we're going to treat that as a, quote, public necessity case for which no compensation is going to be needed. On the other hand, suppose the military wants to do the following. It says, we have a terrible problem on the front, and what we need to do is instantaneously confiscate 10,000 rifles that are held by private firms and send them over to the front. Generally speaking, since those rifles were not in the line of fire, what the government could do is known as a quick take. You could take them right away and send them over because of the emergency. But since they were private property, which in any circumstances would have normally survived, the rule has always been on these quick takings is that after the fact, you determine the compensation that is owing. In this particular case, I do not believe that the president has the power to take the land first on a massive scale, try to put some stuff up, and then tell hundreds of thousands of people you have to sue the United States when we're not even sure that there's a budgetary appropriation that's going to deal with it. It seems to me that at the very least, this entire thing has to go exactly through channels on virtually every particular point, and that this is just a massive form of overreaching. I might also add, by the way, this is a crazy response to an emergency. It will take years to build that wall. Indeed, there are some places where it's probably not possible to build a wall. And then if you build it, as all the critics have said time and time again, how does stuff get through? They come through in vehicles which are concealed. No wall is going to stop that. There are people who deal with their visas and overstay their welcomes. No wall is going to deal with that. There are people who land by sea and don't come over the land barrier. No wall is going to do that. So this wall turns out to be a grand gesture, I think. I cannot believe that it will work. This is not the wall you're putting up if you're an Israeli to separate you from the Palestinians, where, in effect, the raids to kill and destroy people were effectively stopped by a wall. Much shorter wall, much easier to police, to electrify, and to do a lot of other things. And that was not done by emergency powers. It was put up in recognition that this is a constant long-term threat, which needs some kind of a durable solution.
So walk me through the sequence here. If the president did attempt to do this, to invoke these emergency powers, if he did this tomorrow, how does this progress? What do the legal challenges look like? Who has standing to bring them? And what do you think is most likely in terms of the ultimate outcome?
Oh, this is a miserably hard question. We are in terra incognita, since nobody has ever tried anything like this before. And one of the things I always say, you put truly smart lawyers on both sides of a novel question. Within 48 hours, you're moving into parts of the world that nobody understands and nobody anticipates. So everything I say here is deeply contingent. But let's start with the beginning, which is always the question about standing. And here, it's very difficult to figure it out. But let me give you some of the variations. If the government walks on anybody's land and tries to basically use it to construct something, at that particular point, you have a property owner with a discrete interest, and he can challenge this. And when he challenges, he says that this thing is not going to be legal because it's a trespass for which no compensation is owed. And then the president's going to have to put the emergency justification in place. My view is a court is allowed to pass on it. And if the arguments that I made were correct before, that this is not an emergency in the standard set of the terms, the president ought to lose. So that's one argument. The second argument is the one having to do with appropriations. During the Obama administration, you will recall that the president was very anxious to fund the Obamacare situation, and he wanted to transfer some funds which had not been authorized or appropriated by Congress to do this. And there was a case in the D.C. Circuit, and it was held pretty emphatically that the House of Representatives, then in Republican hands, did have standing to protect its power under the Constitution to be the sole source of appropriations and could therefore block this thing. I think it is rumored that the House is now in Democratic hands, that Ms. Pelosi is now a Speaker of the House. So I think they would probably have an authority to challenge this on the grounds that the president is trying to use an appropriation that was not being made. This is going to get very complicated because the administration is going to argue there are funds that were previously appropriated in a general unmarked fund, and we can take them out of that fund and put them to this purpose, to which the House of Representatives will supply. You can only do so for one of a suite of things that have already been approved. You cannot take it if it's been authorized for anything from A through F and then use it for G, H, or I. And who knows which way that argument will come out. My guess is that the president will start to lose on that particular ground as well. So I think, in effect, that the judicial fights will be very powerful. And the other question is, what's the fight going to be over? The first fight is going to be over a temporary injunction. And the argument that the administration will have to make in order to stop that is saying, if we don't do it now, the whole situation will fall apart. The problem with that argument is we haven't done it for 20 years. And so no court is going to start to say that the situation is so radically different from what it was before that you're going to get the interim ability to continue with this war. What's going to happen is the interim ability will be to suspend the operation of this, and the president won't be able to move until this stuff gets through the court system. I don't think he's going to win in any forum that is likely to hear this case. And remember, if it's a challenge to the wall along a 2,000-mile border, it is the challengers who will get to pick the particular location in which they're going to make the challenge. And, you know, some of this territory is in the Ninth Circuit, of course. California, I think, has a border with Mexico, as does Arizona. Anything there could start to happen. So I think it's that way. The other possible situation is, what's Congress going to do? And, you know, this is very, very tricky. Because the one thing, suppose both houses decide to pass legislation and the president vetoes it, and then they override the veto. At that particular point, I think it's very difficult for the president to proceed on any residual power when it turns out that there's an explicit, flat-out overruling of his preferences by both houses of Congress, which comports with the general rules for the passing of legislation one way or another. So I don't think, in effect, he can survive that. If he tries to do it, there's also the possibility of impeachment being brought on the grounds that the activity has now been determined to be lawless. It upsets the basic balance. It counts as a high crime and misdemeanor. And so this is not, you know, one of these crazy obstruction charges, which I think are very, very weak for impeachment ground. This would be something where it's all public knowledge, and the president would have to face that kind of a risk. So I don't think he's going to do it. If I were his advisor, I'm sure he would not listen to me. But if he did, I would say to him, you know, let's be blunt about it. I don't count myself as the leading member of his fan club, but I would advise him most dramatically to use it as a talking point, but not as a way to try to break the particular impasse. Because the other thing that would happen to him, the moment he says, I'm going to build this wall without your consent, he's got no reason to shut down anything anymore if he thinks he could proceed unilaterally. And that's the only lever he has. I regard this and the Syrian situation as a set of bizarre miscalculations by the president, and one of the derbies that we've had running on this show now for just about 2 years is, will this man make it through to the end of the term? And, you know, the odds have always been non-negligible, say 5% or 10%. With his last two fiascos on this stuff and with respect to the Syrian intervention, I think the chances of him leaving have probably doubled to, say, about 10%. By one means or another. I don't put the Mueller calculation there because I don't think that's going to make a big part. This stuff is much more popular and much more view. And I think the president is really overplaying what is, to my mind, a relatively weak hand.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.